Stamattina mi sono alzato, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Stamattina mi sono alzato e ho trovato l'invaso.
Welcome to Rabble Rants. I'm Santiago Helo Quintero, and alongside Jesse McLean, we're going to unpack the stories that have us most riled up and challenge the narratives around them.
Welcome. If you're listening to this rant on the Blueprints of Disruption feed, we're happy to announce that these Rabble Rants now have their own feed under that very name. We've linked it in the show notes to make it easier for you to find. So we have a call to action for us. Can you subscribe to us there, but also share us. Share us with a friend, a comrade, another agitator, maybe someone who needs a little encouragement to disrupt. Point them our way, will you? Let's get to today's episode. We've got some good news, a lot of victories to share, a lot of actions over the past week or two that have yielded tangible results for the pro-Palestinian movement in Canada. We're going to start with two in Toronto, where protesters managed to shut the events down as well as draw some really interesting attention to the movement and possibly movement in terms of the Canadian federal government's positions. So let's get to them. Outside the AGO on March 2nd, protesters, they were successful. There was supposed to be a big gala there. It was Prime Minister Trudeau was welcoming the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. I feel like that was like a twofer because, I mean, anywhere Trudeau goes obviously is fair game, but then you throw a whole fascist prime minister and it's just you don't really need any more excuses to shut this one down, and they did such a good job.
Yeah, I cannot believe that we had, well, no, you know what, that's not true. I can't
not anymore.
It's more that I'm incredibly fucking frustrated at, you know, the reception that we give to a literal fucking fascist, you know, Meloni, who's carrying on the legacy of Mussolini, who's the OG fascist, right? That obviously should not be surprising. You know, we applauded a fascist in parliament. We're supporting a fascist regime in Israel. At the same time, there was something about, you know, I quite like the AGO.
That's the Art Gallery of Ontario. We're always so...
I go there when it's free sometimes. Yeah, I bringing the Italian prime minister there felt very just like...
ick.
Fuck you. Yeah, like very ick. Very icky. Seeing that it got shut down, but also seeing all of the discourse online afterwards was so funny. Like...
I don't know how many times we've mentioned him on the show, that MP Marco Mendicino. He tried to get all the Italians really riled up about this, like feeling like they were victimized. And I obviously it was framed as anti-Semitic. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the tactics, though. I was watching it. I was not there. I was watching it on the live stream. Kudos to whoever was hosting it. The Art Gallery of Ontario has many, many entrances. Obviously, it's like main entrance, and ideally, these folks would have been photographed kind of going in, standing tall in their pretty outfits through the main entrance, their chosen entrance. And so that was where protesters seemed to start. And, you know, at the beginning of every action, you don't quite have the numbers that you do maybe half hour, 45 minutes in once people know that it's on or get down there. And so they had one entrance blocked, but it quickly became apparent that security for the attendees were going to bypass that entrance and use one of the many, many back doors, side doors that the AGO had. And the response of the activists on site there was impressive. They quickly realized what was happening, saved the proper amount of numbers for one entrance, and then quickly moved participants around the building, stopping at each entrance, stationing enough people there, and then continuing on. And they just continued to kind of bolster these numbers strategically in places that made it almost impossible for the guests to get in. And then when security really tried to push the issue, when the big guns came out, when Hamad Hussein showed up, they tried to clear a path through the one entrance, and then the protesters used an excessive amount of noise. I shouldn't say excessive because it was successive. It was just really, you could see it was really jarring for the MP, even for their security detail and the cops. They were just flinching and just like, they just wanted to turn away from it. And in the end, that's exactly what they did. People got great footage of the MP of, now this is the Minister of International Development. This is the man responsible for cutting the funding to UNRWA, to the UN refugee funds for people of Palestine. And they were all turned away. And in the end, it was canceled. They canceled the event. And I guess Marco Mendicino didn't get his chance to rub elbows with his favorite fascist. He got particularly worked up. But yeah, like you said, a lot of people, the Sun was using its typical pro-Hamas language to describe the protesters.
You know, this is one of those occasions where, you know how everyone likes to bring up the what would you have done during, you know, Nazi times and stuff. Here we have a literal OG Italian fascist. It can't be more clear than that about whose side people are on. And can I just say, like, the whole Marco Mancino thing? I mean, first of all, I lived for a long time in an Italian neighborhood. My partner's Italian, and every Italian that I've talked to has found this incredibly funny because Italy does have the fascist history. It also has a very rich anti-fascist history. And to assume that Italians are just going to go along with the pro-fascism is incredibly misguided. And we saw a ton of that on Twitter.
You going to play Bella Ciao in the opening?
Yeah, absolutely. Always a big fan of some good, you know, anti-fascist.
That's been waiting in the wings.
Just yeah. So that was really funny. It's also one of the things that this shows, you know, is the disruption of events when you have the right numbers and there's actual politicians there who have images that they need to preserve.
Yeah.
Those are a recipe for success, right?
They are. Like, that was really bad press for Trudeau, for MP Hussein. It was an embarrassment for the Toronto police. Another funny story. So, obviously, the event got shut down. They couldn't control the situation, thankfully. At some point, they even had many of their horses, all the king's horses and all the king's men seemed to be out there trying to push the crowd back. And after the event was shut down and the protesters dispersed, the police lined up at the main entrance for a photo. So it was just them, no one around them. They were holding down the situation, and That image was taken after the protest. So they were trying their best to improve their PR around that because all the money that they're given, and they still couldn't make way for PM Trudeau to get through to his gala dinner. And I don't imagine that went over well for them. So I hope some cop somewhere is really upset, and that makes me happy.
I think that's the funniest part too, right? I wonder what impression this left on, you know, Giorgia Meloni. Like, I hope she's like, oh, you know, they can't even control a small little uprising at an art gallery. What is this, you know?
Rookies.
Like, you know.
Another successful shutdown, though, just the other day, Chrystia Freeland. We never need any. That's all you need to know. You know, she was showing up somewhere, so you can shut it down. That is a green light. But she was also with Yara Sachs. That's the MP for York Centre. And she's been a particular treat during all of this. And they were planning a $750 a plate fundraiser that I think a lot of folks might want their money back or not. I mean, they're just throwing their money at liberals anyway. So their conscience is not an issue. But protesters, again, you know, used the amount of numbers that they had, formed a human chain, linked arms. They were singing. They attempted to block the entrance, but police apparently were there to enforce the bylaw of the amount of clearance you need to give a business, if there even is one. I'm not sure what their justification there was, but they cleared a space so pedestrians could get by. Some folks did get in, but in the end, Chrystia Freeland did not show up. And when the folks at, I believe it was Eglinton Lawrence, Don Valley for Palestine, our friends over there, asked police if Yara Sachs had made it in, the MP for York Center, and the cop didn't know who she was. And so that was a fun little moment for everyone to just shit on her a little bit. Yeah, I thought, I was watching that on the live stream, and one, not only were they successful in shutting it down, but they had the forethought or whatnot, a planning of having banners, clear banners that described the purpose of the event. And those people were outward facing to the public, and the rest of people's energies were focused on the restaurant and the attendees in there. But then anyone passing by, driving by, taking photos knew exactly why everyone was there. The messaging was kind of facing outright. So yeah, it was a tiny entrance. I think just like one entrance. Yorkville's pretty small. So it was, I think, a little bit easier to shut down than the AGO. But nonetheless, I think it's becoming clear to these liberals that they are not going to be able to fundraise as usual. There is no business as usual at all for these MPs, especially if they've got public events that have been broadcast in any way. So kudos to those folks there that move quickly on that one.
This is exactly what we like to see, right? People like Garcia Freeland shouldn't be able to go absolutely anywhere without being met by a crowd, much less a schmancy dinner in the middle of the city. No, you know, like I hope that if they want to be able to successfully run their fundraisers, they're going to have to go into the middle of nowhere where no, you know, a town of 50 people with a singular restaurant and bring in some private chefs or something to be able to pull that off, because in the city, no, they should never, ever be able to do that.
And they're not, right? At least not here, not Vancouver. There's a lot of core places that are doing a great job of pretty much making those folks persona non grata on top of other institutions that are really fucking around. So to our next action, it's part of a larger action that is in New Jersey and New York as well, because there are real estate agents endorsed by Keller Williams. They're called My Home in Israel. Here in Ontario, there's a realtor, Darren Rich, who is using spaces at synagogues to hold sales, real estate sales, of illegally occupied Palestinian land. These are Zionist settlements that have been deemed illegal. And the receipts are all over. I'll link you to folks that have taken screenshots of the real estate listings as they were up. Because of the amount of attention that this has gotten, they've been taken down. Keller Williams, the real estate investment company there, is trying to distance themselves from the people actually holding this. Either way, it was part of their network and their listings. And this, I imagine, is a fucking crime. So you have folks in Canada buying illegally occupied land. And during this fucking genocide, the fact that they'd have the gall to have these events right now makes me so fucking angry. Like, I'm starting to shake talking about this one. Also because I was there in Thornhill when an action organized by Gada Sasa, we've had her on our show before, we called it Courage Needed to Advocate for Palestine. That episode actually dropped on October 5th. And it's so ironic that like a few days later, it was like, became so obvious how much courage it would actually take. This was a hard one to organize for Gada because it was inside a synagogue. It had originally been planned for a community center, but the city got whiff of it, was like, hell no, that is way too hot potato. You got to move it. And so the realtor managed to secure space at the BAYT synagogue in Thornhill. And obviously, with the movement being painted as anti-Semitic with everything they do, the idea of advertising a protest outside a synagogue was a hard one. People are trying to manage image, and I'll admit, when it was at the community center, you know, I told Gada I would be there. And then I did second guess for a moment going when it was moved outside the synagogue. And then I asked myself, what the fuck am I worried about? Am I worried about, like, image? Am I worried about the anti-Semitic label? Because I get that every time I post about anything anyway. And I felt really silly, and it was not a good moment for me to even have those doubts. That action wasn't able to shut it down because the numbers weren't there at the beginning.
A consideration is not only, you know, about personal image and in times like that, but I imagine part of the worry was also about how the movement itself might look, because, you know, we know what's going on here. We know why they chose to move it to a synagogue of all places, right? It's being set almost as a type of bait. Like, come shut it down if you dare, right? They have these statements lined up already. You know, it's not just about the personal choices, but it's about the movement. And it's something that I don't think it's silly to be thinking about that. I think it's important to always be considering how our actions might affect the movement. But in this case, you know, you sit there, you think about it, you make the decision, and you go, you know. But I think it's okay to have doubts for a second there.
In terms of, like, the movement, you know, if Gata calls me into battle, I'm going. You know, if she has given me the green light on something. But, yeah, I do understand the kind of issues that are built in there. Thankfully, though, there is another, not thankfully, there's another sale, but there is another sale set for today, expecting a counter protest as well here in Thornhill. And then there was one last week in Montreal where independent Jewish voices did mobilize against that sale. Now, I don't think anyone was successful in shutting down the events. I apologize if I'm incorrect, but they surely aren't doing these sales in the dark anymore. And hopefully there's some repercussions here, because I know the listings have been removed from Keller Williams' website, but we know that the sales are still going on through My Home in Israel Realtors. And with all of what we know coming from the ICC, I can't believe that authorities haven't, well, I can believe it, but it's very hypocritical that they're considering granting injunctions against protests against illegal sales. Like, injunctions are usually because, you know, there's been economic hardship. They've got to keep business going. There's something that needs to keep happening. And so you issue an injunction so it can keep happening. And they're thinking of greenlighting that. There's also talks going on that involve IDF soldiers in Montreal, like talking about how great it is to be in the IDF. And those are recruitment sessions. And again, any protests outside of there have been labeled, as we can imagine that they've been labeled, but surely that is also illegal. I know it is. I know it's illegal to recruit for a foreign military service on Canadian soil, but this has been going on for a long time. It used to happen at York University. But the fact that it's still happening now during the genocide, when they can imagine what the mobilization against it would be, is fucking maddening. But none of them are without resistance. We can't talk about the Thornhill action, though, without talking about the violence, the hatred, and the vitriol that was there. So all y'all have probably heard about the nail gun. A man, 27, in the parking lot of where folks were mobilizing to go down to the blockade, firing a nail gun, yelling, like, fuck all Palestinians, and otherwise getting physical with people. And that was not even close to the only act of violence and real agitation that went on there. Just to kind of paint the picture for folks who haven't maybe seen the videos or photos from it, the police eventually did push the pro-Palestinian side to the other side of the street. So it became impossible to actually shut down the event. The numbers weren't quite there. I would say the numbers were maybe matched, but if anything, the pro-Palestinian side was outnumbered and it became a bit of a speaker battle. They had speakers set up on both sides and the Israelis were pumping out dance music, other kinds, like... They were just really celebrating, waving IDF flags and yelling the most horrific shit you can imagine in the faces of people who've lost family members. Like Santiago, they're like, how about 100,000 children? Why not more?
Yeah, yeah. I've heard the same things being said at plenty of counter protests around the city. One thing though about this, the message behind this event selling off land on in occupied Palestinian territory was not something lost on anyone who was there. What I mean to say by that is that this was kind of a symbolic thing for them, where it was almost, it wasn't even about selling one or two parcels of land. It was about getting to do that while in Canada. That was an intentional thing. It was a giant fucking middle finger. It was a message. And that was clear when you see, I mean, I wasn't there personally, but when I saw the clips of everything that was being said there, everything that was happening there, it was incredibly clear that this was a message.
It had the real feels of those videos of IDF soldiers kind of holding up Israeli flags and declaring the land theirs. And, you know, they had obviously a lot of police presence and a loudspeaker. And the Zionists across the street felt no ways about calling everyone on the other side Hamas supporters, jihadists. Like, there was hate speech and incitement to hatred and violence from those microphones. And, you know, the police obviously are not there to protect us. We've talked that about many times. And so the attempt was to drown them out. At some point, folks even tried to strike up dialogue using the loudspeaker with the Zionists. And I thought, I hate talking about the tactic, like, negatively, but let's try to be constructive, because we've already talked about keeping your focus, like, on your own people. And that really wasn't happening there. I think once it became clear that the sale could not be shut down, it was about, like, maintaining spirit on your side, or perhaps shifting tactics, because it was just like this screaming match back and forth of the same talking points that we have on social media, and they would respond with the same ridiculous responses that you would get in your replies. And it's just I don't think people really wanted to hear that over the loudspeaker. It wasn't doing anything. Actually, the best moments were, there was incredible community accountability down there, both in dealing with the violence. Like, if you've seen the video of how they responded to the man with the nail gun, they charged him. You know, there are folks that went chest to chest and were ushering him out of the space and filming him and trying to contain him as best as possible at their own personal peril. And also, at one point, the police attempted, well, they did grab a pro-Palestinian protester, carrying them, you know, by the arms and legs away. And at no moment were they not surrounded by a mass of people screaming at them to let her go. And eventually it was just impossible for the police to move anymore. And they actually kind of handed her over to protesters who dragged her almost to safety. It was a bit chaotic, and formed a protective circle around her and formed a protective circle around them. And on top of that, they were handing out food. There was just a lot of community spirit down there, but there was a real knowledge that if we were going to need to be safe, that was our job. Even though there was a line of police on either side, the amount of times they allowed Zionists to cross the street and come into our group and accost and yell and scream and push and unaccounted for, you know, just made it very clear to everyone, thankfully, down there that was the community's role. And I think there's nothing that kind of lays that bare is when, like, you participate in something that actually replaces the police need, that you understand that there is a possibility without them. So that exposure for people is important, as awful as it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there was a lot of symbolic victories that came from that, both in showing, as you mentioned, you know, showing who keeps us safe. We fucking keep us safe. You know, we know that. But I think also exposing a lot of hypocrisy. And I think it was effective in exposing the hypocrisy. One, because we know when, you know, everyone knows about the Mount Sinai incident. When I say that, the claims that Mount Sinai was targeted, everyone's heard about, you know, politicians coming out and condemning hateful speech on the Palestinian side, you know, whatever they claim from the river to the sea really means, right? Here you have an instance where there's actual no possible other interpretation except hate speech going on. You have actual violence going on. You have international law being broken literally right there. The silence, or the both the silence and the twisted narratives from politicians and from the media were incredibly clear. One, many of the articles written about the nail gun incident had some of the most vaguely possible written headlines that any rational person who was reading it would probably assume that the person with the nail gun was a pro-Palestinian protester.
Yeah, CP24 was man arrested for assault with nail gun at pro-Palestinian protest. He wasn't at the fucking protest. He was part of the counter protest, and it was kind of a step away from the actual protest. But it purposely misled. It wasn't even vague. It was like it was purposely written so that you would think that.
Yeah, yeah. And there's all kinds of studies about the power of headlines, right? How many people actually read the content of an article versus reading the headline. Maybe they read the first couple sentence. That is incredibly and intentionally misleading.
Is there no repercussions, though, like for CRTC? Like, you're the journalism student here. Like, that headline was purposely misleading. There's nothing.
No. It's
false advertising.
No, because of the fact that it was a significant event and it was happening quickly. You know, they could argue like the public needed to be informed.
But it's still up.
I know. But there's nothing that can be done because it's not actually factually incorrect. It's just misleading. Right. And you can.
So all we can do is they're like try to ratio those assholes.
And yeah. Yeah. We can expose
clarify.
It.
But
yeah. Secondly, is the fact that there was incredible amounts of silence from the vast majority of politicians. Olivia Chow being one. Now, Olivia Chow, I'm just going to take a second here because some of the folks from Eglinton Lawrence, you know, they ran into Olivia Chow and they got the opportunity to ask her about why she has stood by and has not taken down her statement about the so-called, you know, anti-Semitism at Mount Sinai. Now, she said that she would only answer off the camera and then told them off the camera that, you know, because of her anti-racism training, that essentially, even if something doesn't occur, it's important to speak out against it, regardless of whether or not it was, you know, accurate or not. Well, Olivia, where's your statement about the actual hate speech going on against Palestinians?
And the nail gun. Like, Jesse Brown has the nerve to talk about the Montreal protest of the same sale and completely leave out what had happened a few days earlier in Thornhill. Same issue, same kind of mobilization, same realtors, and he has lots to say about the issue in Montreal. Not a word about the violence. And not a word, also, all these outlets that are reporting on this protest and the nail gun, they're failing to really pick up what is being protested. So then it does appear that they're protesting a synagogue because they're not picking up the fact on the stolen land. Like, these are villages in the West Bank. And
because one of them did give it good coverage. One of them interviewed Gada. And interviewed one of the...
Well, the CBC did have Gada on, I know. She was able to speak along someone from Jews Say No to Genocide.
Yes, and they also had one of the realtors. Yeah, the comments by the realtor were incredibly weak. They were very much not prepared to speak on this whatsoever. And that's the thing, is that when you actually, you know, I get told every fucking day of the week, that, you know, you got to cover both sides of things. And it's funny because then I pull up articles about the topics I want to write about where nobody's talking about both sides, whatever. I'm not salty about that whatsoever. But here's a case where they actually fucking spoke to us, which they never do usually, right? But they actually spoke to Gada. They actually spoke to Jews Say No to Genocide, and they had the realtor. Okay, perfect. How did they look in comparison? Anybody watching that walks away knowing exactly what's going on because you see the shitty fucking arguments they have because they got nothing. It falls apart under the slightest amount of actual scrutiny. They have nothing.
There is nothing. Well, we just talked about that the other day on the phone, right? Where it was like, well, no wonder they don't respond to you. Who's going to respond to you? Because there's no defense. Like, you can't write a line. I don't care how good your PR person or your lawyer is. There is no statement, especially on camera. Like, I can imagine a written statement. You can just drop some gobbledygook like Selena Robinson did and, like, walk away and not answer any questions. But to agree to get on camera and try to defend selling illegal land, also at an event where someone used violence in that way. But talking about the condemnations or lack thereof, even Jagmeet's was really the only one that I saw. And that came 3 days after the fact. They're always very quick on one end. And then they probably need to confirm a million times over mm-hmm. on the other end.
They're like, oh, a nail gun. I think we can speak out against this one.
Yeah, that seems safe. That seems safe. But I would wonder how people would feel about, like, their place of worship being used for this kind of sale during these kinds of times. And the congregation there released a letter that said the war against Israel spilled over into Thornhill today. And so they are seemingly openly declaring themselves, like, as part of the war, as defending Israel from within Canada. But one thing that this brought up, not just the nail gun, it was a lot of agitators came over and tried to pick fights. And we do need to teach each other more self-defense. We talk about tactics. We talk about a lot of skills that are great to pick up for activism. Building databases is one, you know, marshalling is one. There's so many, but I feel like some MMA.
Jess, are you a fan of Dead Prez?
Yeah, I know of them, but I, like, you're going to make me sound uncool now, so you better edit this out.
Well, I bring them up because when it comes to this, I think people should definitely, first of all, go listen to the album Let's Get Free by Dead Prez. Go listen to that.
Is that vinyl you're holding
up?
Yes,
it is. And then I would recommend one of the rappers in the group, Stickman. He has a book called The Five Principles, A Revolutionary Path to Health, Inner Wealth, and Knowledge of Self. I recommend checking this out because they're huge in terms of talking about what, when it comes to, you know, self-defense, being in the right mindset and approach to actually being able to stand up during these times to defend ourselves, to fight, what needs to be done to keep ourselves, you know, healthy. I think they're a great resource for that, and their music is incredible. So I'm just going to take a second to plug my favorite album of all time.
I'll also, at this point, recommend Frontline Medics if folks want to follow them on Instagram, because they provide a lot of tactical advice in terms of frontline protesting, even from how to configure yourself. It almost looks like battle plans. And really it is. So check those folks out. There'll probably be lots of links in today's show notes because we want you folks replicating what we're talking about. That's the whole point of the show in general. And today, I don't know, today being March the 7th, folks out east and in Toronto have been blockading Kraken Technologies. So there is an office in Toronto that was shut down, their headquarters in St. John's, and they've got a factory just outside of Halifax. Kraken Technologies is responsible for something called Catfish. And that particular technology allows Israel to use unmanned ships to enforce the blockade on Gaza. So when Justin Trudeau says we provide non-lethal means or technology to Israel, these are the kinds of things they get away with calling non-lethal, as though you can call the blockade of a people's non-lethal, as though it has no social murder built into it whatsoever, right? Like there's nothing wrong with cutting off food and supplies to a densely populated area, one that is now under bombardment. These are the kind of ships that fire on Gazan fishermen as they try to get fish. So non-lethal my ass. So kudos to folks like World Beyond War for organizing that and all the affiliates that were involved. But, you know, again, they took a small amount of people to shut down the offices in Toronto because it's just like one headquarters. It looked like maybe 10 people there. Same with the blockade that shut the morning shift down for 2 hours outside the Halifax factory. It wasn't a massive amount of people, but they had a very long banner. They spread themselves out. You know, they're talking to the workers who are trying to get in. I believe they're like slowing it down. I'm not sure if it was a hard picket or not. Maybe we can get somebody on to give us the scoop. The idea was, you know, it was coordinated across the country to a degree, and they were very good at sending out coordinated press releases and photos as they were there. And so everyone started talking about it. And not only were they talking about the action, but they backed it up with all of this information on why they're shutting it down. And it's perfect timing because just 2 days ago, you know, folks on the other end doing what they can do, launch a lawsuit against the Canadian federal government to get them to stop sending arms over to Israel based on the ruling of the international court that is contributing to genocide. And so it's a combination of all of these pressures that will hopefully get people to the next kind of step. I know folks really celebrating the reinstatement or reported reinstatement of UNRWA funding. That hasn't been confirmed as of while we're recording this, but it is rumored by the CBC and the department did have a press conference scheduled on that topic to reinstate the $25 million payments and also increased financial contributions. So this is a complete reversal of the position that they had just a few weeks ago, where they cut off funding and were trying to paint the organization as some sort of bed of Hamas and use that while people are starving to cut off aid. And then that same minister, he has the nerve to go over to Jordan and pose with Canadian food airdrops while they're cutting funding. Same with the U.S. airdrops of aid. It's just so maddening to see them try to get votes. I know people are being fed and they'll take something, like it's better than nothing, but the amount of legs that kind of goodwill gets is often erases the harm that they're doing. But yeah, so there's been other political repercussions as well from all of this pressure. We'll revisit the MLA Selena Robinson issue just momentarily here because she has now resigned from the NDP entirely. She's going to sit as an independent. She's already kind of told us she's not going to run again. So we've pretty much already done with her. But on her way out, she issues this 4-page letter. I hinted towards it earlier. It's just trash. She throws some of her colleagues under the bus. I mean, I'm no fan of the NDP. They might be well deserving of it. But the point is, she didn't take any accountability. She's still conflating the issue as like Muslims and Jewish people and how those communities have to come together. And I've seen a lot of that shit from the progressive left, trying to promote conferences that are bringing like Arabs and Israelis together to move forward. And I'm just not here for that. The way that they're painted is because they're including Zionists in these discussions. And first of all, it's not between Muslims and Jewish people. We're talking about the state of Israel and Palestinians, which, yes, is predominantly Muslim, but they encompass other religions. And this conflict, or whatever word you want to give to it, isn't based on the two religions, like, whatsoever. Gladly, though, a lot of fallout.
Yeah.
It's become very uncomfortable to be a politician that supports Zionism right now. And that shift is really becoming more obvious, I think, day by day.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you look at everything we talked about so far today as a whole, I think this represents a shift, I think, for sure, where First of all, look, I love seeing people in the streets. The kind of response that Toronto and other cities have gotten, you know. I've gone down to my fair share of weekend protests. But we always talk about how the need for actual disruption, and what we've seen here is the growth of and success of actual disruption. And that is incredibly important. The fact that the narrative is being harder and harder to be controlled. You know, like, there was a protest at a synagogue. We know the reasons for it. We've talked about it here. But at the end of the day, there was a protest at a synagogue, and that didn't turn into a huge anti-Semitism story. The Mount Sinai got more anti-Semitism blowback than the synagogue did.
I think that's because of the nail gun, though.
It's absolutely because of the nail gun. But, you know, the nail gun doesn't come out when there's non-disruptive protests, you know? And I don't want the nail guns to come out at all. Like, I'm not an accelerationist here, you know? I don't wish to incur violence upon ourselves in order to make a point. I'm never going to want that. But what I'm saying is, you know, there was a disruption at a synagogue and it didn't get nearly as much anti-Semitism blowback as one would expect. This is the kind of momentum that needs to be kept building on. And, you know, it's going on as we speak, like as we're recording this episode right now. This is how we get change. I think there's a lot to be hopeful here.
Okay, then I'm not going to go straight to the warning I had for folks. I'll first share two tactics that came to light this week for me that I'm going to quickly just share because they can be easily replicated, and I'm here for that. So folks on the New York subway enter with lots of people and electric drills, ads ready to place that match the size of the ads you typically see on transit. Obviously, a transit worker perhaps helped them with the hex bolt or whatever bolt they needed, either way. And they quickly entered the subways, changed all the advertisements to kind of satire or really overt messaging about the genocide in Gaza, and then disembarked, right? Got the necessary video to promo without faces, and the work was done. I don't know how long it takes transit to clean that up, but it's just an example of probably very low resource, very low time commitment, and quite a lot of impact because it's replicated then on social media, right? Not everybody has to get on that subway car, but everyone sees that, is inspired, and kind of gets on the bandwagon, so to speak. Another one is, I know we've kind of talked about it before here when we had Dimitri Lascaris on in terms of confronting ministers, but it's been used a few times, and most famously, folks might have seen the video of people disrupting a New York congresswoman's meeting, and it looks like it's in a church, and, you know, a white man is sitting in front of a masked young protester screaming, you know, sit mm-hmm. down, sit down. Okay, so that video there, the tactic I'm talking about is planting people that aren't obviously protesters, right? So they're dressed for the occasion, they're smiling and nodding along with the program, and then someone stands up and accosts and confronts, and they're obviously removed by security. You let the event resume for enough time for folks to feel comfortable, and then you disrupt again and again and again. And it's rather than everyone standing up, making a scene, and all being ushered out at once, you really do make it impossible for them to hold the event, because then everyone's also very anxious and they're waiting for the next person to stand up. And it's just, it really must frazzle the shit out of politicians.
Mm-hmm. No, and that one was the one in New York that you're talking about. That one was really funny because, I mean, seeing these old men, they were just losing their heads, like the way that one guy was shouting shut up. And I feel bad for their poor wives sitting beside them.
I mean, she kind of laughed at first. I feel like she was prepared for that,
but they were having to be like, no, shut up, stop it, stop making a fool of yourself, come on. And I felt bad for them, to be honest.
Well, don't.
The wives, I mean. Like, a lot of town halls and things, a lot of these meetings are, you know, primarily attended by older retirees. They're not used to facing that kind of actual blowback at these events. I think it's absolutely great for them to actually have to face that. you know, they're not getting it on Fox News at night.
Have you seen the one with Lockheed Martin CEO giving a guest lecture, I suppose, or taking questions from a university class? So they're all in their tiered seats, you know, staring at, it's remote, he's on camera, and the students all start their questions so respectably and on topic. And then right at the end, they work in a, so how closely will I be contributing to the genocide of Palestinians? You know, I understand, you know, this is how the structure works and this would be my tasking. And, you know, when you guys, I think it opens the video that you're watching. It was a question about the F-35 fighter jet, how it was designed and how many children do you think you've killed with that plane? You know, and he doesn't know what to do. I imagine the professor is sweating so bad.
Satire is one of our most powerful tools. You know, shout out to Bassem Youssef. Everyone remembers his interview with Piers Morgan. Satire is an incredibly powerful thing. We need to make as much use of satire as we can because they don't know how to fucking respond to that. They get it when we're angry. You know, they're like, oh, we got this. You know, we'll just yell back and then it's a yelling, pissing match. But you bring out satire, you put on a smile on your face and you, you know, they have no idea what to do with that.
When you look so collected, I know I am guilty. I lose myself sometimes, you know, go to the front line and just scream. That's not helpful. It's a bit of a release, but when you do it kind of in that really calm and collected way, it disarms them as well. Right? Not only are you stymieing them with your wit, but yeah, they really just don't know how to match that energy at that point. I'm going to end the episode with a bit of a warning for folks. I don't know, maybe we should have started with the warning. I hope y'all stuck around then. And it's not new to our movements, but I think it just came to light and was really obvious. So it's not like a tin foil hat moment. It's kind of validated for folks that movements will be infiltrated. There was a collective, I'm not even going to name them because they probably think they're bigger than they are. They claim to be global, whatever. They put out a call for agents embedded behind enemy lines at pro-Palestinian protests. So I imagine they're trying to recruit folks that can attend rallies and appear to be allies and be anything but. So whether it's surveillance or kind of agitating from within, perhaps planting signs that would delegitimize the movement or doing actions counter to the purpose of that particular action. You know, turning nonviolent actions into violent ones. Either way, whatever their intentions are, folks should be aware that people are actively recruiting for things like this. And the police are absolutely already doing this. And so it's not to scare you, but, you know, being aware is like the very least you could do, that it is a possibility, right? Because then it's in your mind. But there are a few steps that you can take, self-promoting. But we've done two, our very first episode is called We Keep Us Safe. There's lots of tips in there, you know, on terms of how to structure your movement into cells, how to have some correspondence above ground, some below ground, varying levels of access to protect yourself against possible infiltrators or people who have not the best intentions, let's say. And because you kind of limit the amount of damage that they can do. Yeah, it's a thing. It's a thing that hopefully you don't spend too much time stressing over, though, because they really are meant to just slow you down as well. Not only to, like, compromise the movement, but spending energy on or perhaps restricting yourself in ways that you can't grow because you're so worried about infiltration is also a detriment. So it's like finding that balance. Vouching is another way that you can help prevent infiltration. Someone must know them somewhere, right? Like someone within your movement has met them or done something. Like that is very helpful. I've been asked to vouch or vouch for people or have been vouched for to enter certain circles. Just kind of keep that in mind as you're organizing out there.
Yeah. It's learn what the typical tactics are of people who infiltrate. You know, they have scripts, they have things that they do. It's you have to learn to be able to identify, have things that set off red flags for you. And part of it is also keeping each other accountable, right? Because one of the tactics that infiltrators like to do is, you know, escalation. I think back to the Black Panthers, they tried to to get them to commit acts of quote unquote terrorism. Some of the infiltrators, right? They wanted to, you know, go through several bombings and stuff. They're trying to push the Black Panthers into that. And there was a lot of pushback from inside of the organization against that. Like, no, what the fuck are you talking about? That these are the kind of things that you see. So read about the tactics because they haven't changed all that much. And there's definitely ways to tell.
One of the things, Santiago, that you reminded me of when you started that statement there was the handbook for CIA operatives. We'll link it, and it's just how to slow down an organization. So not necessarily the tactics of entrapment. It's not that overt, but it's on how to hold a movement back. And it's fascinating because if you read it, it reads like the NDP. It reads like every meeting every chair of every meeting you've ever had within the NDP. It's like always send something to committee, talk really long about nothing.
Haggle over the minutes.
And the wording in resolutions. And it's just eventually, like, you just can't do anything. And they're like cement feet. And I recently learned that Gloria Steinem admits and is known to have been a CIA operative within the white feminist movement. And her goal was to keep it focused on gender and women's issues. I use scare quotes, you know, women's issues instead of class. They wanted to make sure that all of that mobilizing that was going on around the women's liberation movement did not spill over to any kind of class consciousness. And so that, amongst other things that she did for the CIA, that was one of her roles. And so sometimes the infiltrators are your heroes. They are not just somebody who's entered a meeting is yelling from the back, we should burn it down, you know, or like it's ideologues that seem very convincing and will steer you away from doing what you really kind of need to do. And so I thought that would be an interesting thing to bring up because, yeah, it's not just always some shady guy who looks like a cop. Gloria Steinem could be infiltrating your movement. So watch out for those white feminists.
Yeah, I'd check out, there's a movie, Judas and the Black Messiah, about how an infiltrator led to the death of Fred Hampton, the chairman of the Chicago Black Panther Party. In those, it's often people who can get quite close, right? And I also, I have to warn, like, it's also not about living in such fear that we start, you know, suspecting everyone. And solidarity is our most powerful tool, right? It's just about being aware and keeping an eye on things and thinking what exactly are the things that would be detrimental to the movement. What are the things that will bring us harm? And looking out for those things. You might not be able to catch an infiltrator, like, you know, but it's about keeping the movement safe, and you don't need to know who the infiltrators are to do that. We have to still be able to trust each other to an extent. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want people to get super paranoid, you know?
Yeah, I know. Balance. Yeah. There's balance.
Like, you know, there's a study about our ability to tell when people are lying to us, and essentially, something like 58% of the time we can tell, which is just slightly better than guessing.
I think if you factor in the amount of neurodivergence that are within these movements and reassess that lie radar again, I think it'll be a lot higher because...
Like being able to tell if we're being lied to?
Oh, I know when I'm being lied to.
Oh, yeah.
I know for sure. I won't always tell you I know because I need to save that superpower. You can't know I have it. Definitely, I have almost complete faith in that. My LIDAR, as we know, neurodivergent people are drawn to activism. There needs to be a study. I'll talk to Lulu because she doesn't have anything else to do. That's a joke. She's the busiest person I know. But we'll get Lulu back on the show to talk about autistic resistance later. But yeah. Shout out to all those NDs out there keeping it down. That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Helu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content, and if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.